The older I get, I think the easier it is to engage people with curiosity. When I forget, I'm very blessed to have kids who are now teenagers who are delighted to check me and remind me that I don't actually know anything, which helps remind me that I need to shut up and listen.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality. My name is Dave Plisky, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Father John Gribowich. In this season of the podcast, we are speaking with members of all different sorts of faith traditions from around the globe. This episode falls after our first episode with Judaism, which was with AJ Levine last time. And if you missed that one, please go back and listen. It's a fascinating episode, hearing her just give us all the wisdom we could ask for on the Jewish Jesus. And today we'll be talking with two different rabbis about forgiveness and doing the work and community and all sorts of great stuff. So let's get into it. We're going to start with our conversation with Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg. Rabbi Danya is the award-winning author of 8 books and writes at lifeisasacredtext.com. Named by Newsweek as a rabbi to watch and recognized as a faith leader to watch by the Center of American Progress, she has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, Salon, Time, and many other major publications. Her work and commentary have also been featured on NPR, CNN, NBC News, Good Morning America, and across numerous national media outlets. A leading voice on Jewish ethics, faith-based advocacy, and social justice, Ruttenberg has helped organize and mobilize faith communities around issues, including economic justice, accountability, and collective care. She led the network Rabbis for Repro during and after the landmark 2022 Supreme Court decision on abortion law, bringing a distinctly Jewish perspective to one of the most debated moral and legal questions of our time. She has also played an active role in shaping Jewish responses to sexual misconduct and systemic injustice. In addition to her writing and advocacy, she serves on advisory boards, including Educate US and the Shalom Center, continuing her work to foster dialogue, responsibility, and a more compassionate and just world. Rabbi Danya, it's great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Great. So we always kind of like to start by hearing about your background, and particularly your journey in faith as it might have been. And feel free to kind of start as far back as you like, but you know, we just want to know who you are.
Okay. I'm fourth generation Jewish American, and was raised like many Jews in this country. We went to synagogue for the high holidays, observed Passover. I had a bat mitzvah, but it was very kind of assimilated, acculturated otherwise. And somewhere around age 13, looked around synagogue at high holy day services. Nobody had ever told me what any of the stuff meant. We just went and did the thing. And so all the people standing up and sitting down and standing up and sitting down. And I decided that Marx was right about about opiates, and decided I was an atheist. Got interested in the study of philosophy, which accidentally turned into the study of religion when I was in college. It's history, it's literature, it's archaeology, it's whatever's fascinating. And then when I was in college, my mom died of cancer. And we went to, we did the funeral Jewishly because we're Jews. And we did the mourning rituals Jewishly because we're Jews. And I had been reading all of these books on ritual theory from an academic perspective, and suddenly could, kind of understand what was happening. And I'd go to say the mourner's prayer that one says, because I'm a Jew and that's what you do. And was like, oh, I understand what's happening in the liturgy. Here's the rising action and the fall. Oh, this is not so stupid. Oh, who knew? And because I was broken open in grief, I was taking these walks around campus at night and just totally open is the word I keep coming back to. And now I would describe what was happening to me as mystical experiences. Just something was going on, and the lines between me and everything else were getting blurry. And I, over the course of time, was struggling to find language to describe what was happening. And condensing 3 years into, a couple of sentences, but it's like allowing the word spiritual to come into the conversation, and the language got bigger. Or the, sorry, allowing spiritual to come into the mix, and experiences got bigger. And allowing sort of God question mark to come into the mix, and having the realization that perhaps 2,000 years of nuanced theology didn't all think that God was a dude on a mountain with a beard and anger management issues waiting to zap us, but that actually there were theologians who had been describing that same evanescence that I was experiencing. I mean, this was the real, kind of aha moment, and that was somehow connected to my feeling of making friends with what was happening in services, because when a parent dies, you go to services to say the mourner's prayer for a year, basically. So I was kept having to go back and make friends with this thing. It was all very confusing for a while, but starting to try to put these pieces together was messy. And after college, I moved to San Francisco because it was the late 90s and I could. And that was, and I had some friends there. And I was like, okay, I guess I don't hate services enough to want to know where my synagogue would be if I ever wanted to do that. Question mark, question mark, question mark. And after a very Bay Area synagogue shopping experience with a lot of different, very Goldilocks, I stumbled into this place out in the Richmond that, Fifteenth and Clement, as so for those of you who know, and 14th and Clement, and the services felt correct, and then the rabbi opened his mouth, and I said, "Oh," and this was the guy who basically said all those experiences in not so many words, all those experiences you've been having. Yeah, the Torah is aware. And the Torah has been telling you that this is the map to transforming yourself to become connected to this big bigness. And the Torah knows more about this process than you do. And I basically fell over and started following this guy. Rabbi Alan Liu was his name. May his memory be for a blessing. I followed him around for 5 years. And it's his fault that I went off to rabbinical school.
Thanks for sharing that. When you were doing your synagogue shopping, and by the way, I've done my fair share of parish shopping in the past, so I know a little bit about that. But and I'm not really proud of it either, by the way. I don't see it as like a necessarily a positive moment for myself, but it is kind of like it was necessary to kind of go through that, I guess, to realize like there's more similar than different. But when you were doing that, did were you keeping it to the same denomination that you had grown up in with your family, or not necessarily?
So personally, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I encourage people when they're trying to figure things out to take half a year and check out a lot of places. And no, I was looking at everything and having a lot of experiences, because understanding what didn't work gave me a lot of information about who I was, what I was looking for. And as somebody who didn't get a particularly expansive Jewish education, and I think, you know, the Jewish world, all of these worlds are huge, and none of us grow up seeing the full picture. And so when one is in a searching space, to be able to get a taste of everything out there and have those moments of, I didn't even know this was on the menu. And okay, I didn't know that was on the menu, but no, thank you. Right. Now I know. And to just even get a sense of where the map is and what the lay of the land. And maybe the first place you walk into feels like home and you never want to leave. Great. Lucky you. You just saved yourself some headaches. But I don't regret discovering some stuff about myself. That's okay.
I didn't mean to poo-poo it either. I guess I think for me, like, and you're right. It was eye-opening to kind of see some of the different flavors that were out there that you hear about, but now it's like, oh, now I'm actually experiencing it, and that was positive. I think my issue with myself is that I was searching for the wrong reasons, meaning that I was like unwilling to accept community the way community is, and that type of thing, which you can't escape if you're looking for that sort of experience.
Yeah. Unfortunately, wherever you go, there are going to be people. And they're not all going to be perfect, and there's no perfect community, and you have to kind of figure out, at some point you plant your flag and you say, fine, I'm gonna deal with these imperfect ones, right? But if you hate non-consensual hugging, then that service where everybody turns to the person next to you and hugs is never going to be your thing. Mm. But for somebody else, that might be like a revelation and the thing they've been looking for all their life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some people, that kind of chanting might be elevating. And for other people, it might be so not their vibe. And, you know, things I hated when I was 22, I can totally get into now that I'm in my 50s, right? It's, we don't always need the same things at the same time in our lives, and that's okay too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like the fact that you discovered something when you're out here in San Francisco. When I first moved here, maybe not when I first moved here, but when I actually was living in San Francisco proper, I would spend most weekends just kind of peeking my head into different churches and just seeing what was going on. And it was pretty amazing. Like, you know, there's so much, you know, said about the Bay Area as being, I don't know if you want to say highly secular or just something like that, but it's the furthest from that. I think that everything somehow is caught up in the spirit. Everything is somehow caught up in being something more than what it appears. And that there are just genuine seekers and people really entering into experience. I mean, I think that just the very ethos of the area, like just the nature of the area, just it makes it impossible not to be filled with some form of awe that you have to kind of wrestle with, that then translates into where you are within it, you know, somehow. But that's kind of cool. I mean, how long did you stay in the Bay Area?
It was only about 5 years. And then to my dismay, the still small voice kept yelling about rabbinical school. And I was like, do I have to? Hmm. Are you sure?
What did that look like, that process? Like, how did you know where to go, and like, what were you looking for? Because I mean, that's also another type of big decision as to how you feel like you need to follow that trajectory.
A process filled with a lot of agita, as I may, as we say in Yiddish, or spilkies, as we say in Yiddish, really. But that was more the process to go or not. I had fallen into a synagogue that was affiliated with the conservative movement. And that's big C, not politically. It was more about conserving tradition while trying to remain in the modern world. And I give you the whole history of where that, this is before the political connotation. But, yeah, we're going to still pray in Hebrew, even though we're going to try to be post-Enlightenment and et cetera, et cetera. And so I was trained by a rabbi who helped me to think about the observance of Jewish law as like a monastery unto itself, right? That Jewish law, halakha, is a spiritual practice. To take seriously, and that that can hold you and be a transformative space. And so ritually, theologically, I was very much in line with that denomination. Politically, socially, less, but I was in it to go get trained in the right place for the books. And there are two seminaries for that denomination at the time. And I was on the West Coast. And the one on the East Coast, and this is where it all gets really complicated. It was 2002. Queer. I'd been queer for a really long time. It was very don't ask, don't tell at that time. I had some teary conversations with some queer elders who basically told me to just go get ordained and live my life after. In retrospect, that might have been bad advice, but I was 26, 27 at the time. I was taking advice from people who seemed to know what they were doing. Who were already rabbis. And the seminary in New York, I had heard really misogynist things about, and was decidedly less friendly around queer stuff. And the seminary in LA seemed was, the people who were trying to pass queer ordination were there, and they seemed cooler and more spiritual and groovier. And we're closer to my friends. So it didn't seem like a hard choice, ultimately. I only applied to the one place. I helped lead what turned out to be 40 former students of that same seminary. In pushing for investigations into misconduct of various kinds from the two deans of that seminary. So what happened while there is a much longer story. I'm happy to talk about it, but why I thought to go there and what happened while I was there are two very different stories.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you probably were led there for reasons that you didn't even understand then.
I was led there for I wanted to go get trained in the good books, pun intended, I guess, in my good books. I wanted to learn the source code. And I certainly walked out of there you know, the we had rigorous, scary Talmud exam that you had to pass before you could get ordained. And, you know, I walked away knowing the stuff. In retrospect, I wonder about the whether or not I would have made different choices knowing what I know. And it doesn't matter because I'm here and I'm glad to be here and I'm glad to know what I know. So
what was like your studies like if, as far as what you were receiving, let's just say academically and then also like spiritually, how was that kind of also sitting with just the trauma that was kind of unfolding too? Did you find some type of solace in at least, you know, wrestling with the word to be able to kind of navigate through this? Or what how did you hold all that?
Oh, yes and no. Like the studies, the first year or two were very nitty gritty. I mean, you know, Jewish stuff is the deep end. It's not just that your Hebrew has to be at a certain level. You've got to understand all of the technical terms in Aramaic to understand that when the Talmud says my nafkamina, that it's not just asking, it's not just what do those words mean. It's that that's a technical term that's gonna, like, what are the implications of this, right? It's, and, you know, like, there are all of these, like, you have to be able to follow the argument in certain ways. And it's, so there's a lot of building blocks to get to being able to deal with the text on the correct level. My nafkamina is the wrong example, but anybody should know that, obviously.
Well, can you tell us what you mean by that? Just because I'm sure there's
my
a lot of people
who, is what are the implications of this? If a rabbi says that, that's, yeah, I was, yeah. Anyway. But, you know, you like you like the and so there's, but there's the sort of the deep learning in the in understanding Talmud, you know, being able to go both deep into, you know, one discussion. You could spend an entire semester just on one discussion, and you can spend an entire semester burning through a whole chapter quickly so that you can understand the, you know, not just the leaves but the whole forest and be able to see things from the top level. And then all of the commentary, you know, and then they're the dudes writing 100 years later doing the meta commentary and how all of the pieces fit together. There's understanding Torah in its biblical context. There's understanding, then there's a page of Torah with various medieval commentators all fighting about what's going on that page of Torah and engaging with what are they saying and why are they saying it and where is that coming from, right? There's the whole Midrash, which is rabbinic fanfic is not quite the right definition, but it's when the rabbis kind of play jazz on Torah and it's delightful, but it's also being able to get it not just as like, oh, this is cool literature, but to like really get what they're doing and why, and to be able to sort of peel back the layers. It's like, you know, there's watching TV and then there's opening up the TV set to understand how all the wires go. And then there's somebody took apart a TV and you have to be able to reassemble it. And those are three different levels, right? Yeah, so there's, you know, there's, that was like a lot, you know, and then there's like the 16th century Jewish legal codes and what does that mean for what happens today, right? The literally, like, I'm cooking and I'm making meatball stew, but accidentally my milk spoon falls into the meat stew. Now what, right? Kind of stuff. So that you're the rabbi of a synagogue and the like nitty gritty practical stuff, which for us is the monastery, right? It's the angel is in the details. It's being able to help people hold and create that sanctuary in space time. So that, that was like a lot of, that was so much of our time. And, and then there's the pastoral stuff and the, how to give a sermon and, you spend your summers working in the hospital and right, there's all of this other stuff on top of it. And sometimes the Torah was the solace. Sometimes the Torah was the thing that fed me in a very toxic environment. And sometimes the Torah was the toxic environment. 'Cause we're dealing with ancient patriarchal texts, and that's fine. That's a fact. But one always has choices about how to teach it. And when one says, here's a great text that we can use to understand this cool rhetorical device that the rabbis are using, and I'm the one, or my classmate is the one that has to raise their hand and say, are we going to mention the fact that this cool rhetorical device that the rabbis are using is just casually mentioning rape or child abuse as their example? And there are reasons why, and I can walk you through why they were doing that and the rabbis weren't being callous in da 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 da. But you, the teacher, here in the 21st century, have an obligation to, for all of your students of all genders, to discuss this, right? And we don't have to spend all our time. Let's acknowledge, right? It's not cute. Like, we can't just focus on the rhetorical device if we're, right, if we're talking about abuse. Or to be in a class that's on Midrash and, oh, look, it's 2005 and my teacher's only calling on the male students. That's cute. Right? Or, oh, look, I'm being casually sexually harassed or sexually assaulted by one of my teachers. That's, by a guest teacher. That's cool, right? So sometimes Torah was the cure and sometimes Torah was the harm.
Mm.
That's a fact.
Mm.
That's unfortunately the reality in too many religious spaces.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. No, I totally hear what you're saying in that way. How did you personally find your way through all that? Like, what was the, why didn't you just peace out and like, I can't do this? What made you go forward?
I tried so many times. It's like, picture me at Venice Beach, like crying and screaming at God, being like, can't I just leave? Still small voice being like, no, Danya. I had a fantastic support network of people both in LA and inside my computer, in my phone, who were there to witness and help me hold the truth as it was unfolding, including I had, one of those locked blogs where I was able to track what was happening, and a handful of people were reading it. Which is fascinating to come back and read now and be like, are you kidding me? Like, all this stuff was happening. Like, the level of bad is different with these eyes. I think I just had a lot of clarity that this was something I had to do, and it was a few years and I needed to get through it. And when one is in an abusive situation, one so often feels that this is, even as one is talking, I had amazing classmates, And I made the joke then about how many women the seminary shed. But it still didn't occur to me to organize, right? It felt like my problem for me to get through, even as I'm watching my classmates leave and leave and leave and leave. And it was only at, 15 years later, as I'm talking to people about their experiences, that we're all saying, oh, the exact same thing was pulled on you. Oh, okay, right.
Curious about your experience reading Talmud and all the commentaries, and just wonder I wonder if you notice now that your approach to disagreement maybe has changed because of reading so many centuries of disagreement, good disagreement, in your
Yeah, I
text.
mean, it's in me. We have, in my tradition, sacralized, made sacred, holy disagreement, right? So and so says this, Rebbe whoever says, no, you fool. This is absolutely not the case. Here's my proof about why. And, Rebbe first guy says, oh, I'm going to smite your proof, with my plus 2000, mega better proof. And that they go back and forth and back and forth. And then they're laughing and telling jokes by the end of the conversation, right? It's not adversarial. And we say, there's this line from Psalms, right? Iron sharpens iron. And for us, that's, two people who are going at it make each other stronger and better and smarter. And so when I discover that I'm wrong, which is often, I'm delighted to own it because somebody bested me, right? Okay, you won.
Do you think that same approach works when you're talking to someone from a different faith tradition or no faith tradition, where you're not coming, maybe starting in the same foundation, let's say?
Yes. It just as easily, if not more often enough, because I'm curious, I'm interested. The stakes are different. I think the core, my core basis, my core starting point is, are we all going to believe and act like we believe every single human being is created in the divine image and worthy of dignity? Whether or not you believe in God, right? Do we believe every single human being is sacred and a matter of supreme importance? However you want to put it. Not all Jews certainly walk that walk. Certainly don't even talk that talk. Not all anybody of any background do. But if you and I, of whoever background, are on the same page about that, then we are off to the races. And I already know that I've got stuff to learn from you.
Is that so? I know you're big on thinking through forgiveness and as a healing mechanism, I guess that comes maybe after serious disagreement or whatever else might have happened. Tell me more about that and how this all plays a part.
So, for me, the big work is repentance, repair, amends. Someone who causes harm has an obligation. And it's a very Jewish word, right? For us, the sense of true obligation is something that I think we carry, religious Jews carry in a big way. But if you cause harm, you have an obligation to clean it up and to truly own fully in all the ways. And I'm happy to walk through the steps of what I think that means, what Maimonides means as far as I read him. You know, owning your stuff, doing the work, transforming, making amends, making different choices. And that's the big thing. If you are harmed, if your harmdoer has not done the work of repair and amends, you do not, definitely do not owe this person forgiveness at all. It can be healing and it may be the correct thing, but if it's not healing and correct, then do what you need to do to heal. And if your harmdoer has harmed you in a way that involves trauma, then even if they do incredible repair work, as I read Jewish sources, you still don't owe them anything. And once again, that forgiveness can be the right thing, and sometimes it's not. And that's okay. And there are a lot of ways to heal from significant harm.
Actually, let's just unpack that, because I mean, so many people who may even be listening to this are always just thinking the default is forgiveness is a good thing. We always have to forgive, and we know that's far easier said than done. Mm-hmm. And I like how you said that sometimes maybe you can't, and maybe you shouldn't. And what does healing look like outside of, say, forgiveness in the way that we typically understand it to mean? What would you suggest to someone who is struggling to forgive, but knowing that there is a way forward?
So maybe I should start with some of my issues with forgiveness culture.
Sure.
Because I think that, you know, in some places, the sort of forgiveness is so, there's the guilt if I don't.
Right.
In places where there is such an emphasis on forgiveness, but not the work of accountability, what happens? It's usually, not always, but usually when harm happens, often, it's harm or with some sort of power piece involved. Not always, right? It can be siblings, it can be whatever, but friends. But in so many places, there is also this power piece. And when there is pressure to forgive without that accountability, then that, I mean, even when there's no explicit power piece, it maintains the status quo, right? I harm you, you forgive me, nothing changes. That means you get to keep harming me. That means the family ecosystem doesn't change and the harmed party isn't protected. That means that the figure with, you know, a lot of power, you know, white supremacy doesn't change because the cop just got forgiven by the family, whatever it is, right? Nothing changes. Nothing gets better. It makes everybody feel better except the harmed party. Saying, actually, I deserve better and things need to happen is a way of making that ecosystem shift. So that's one piece. Number two, running to forgiveness can be a way to bypass anger. And anger can be a necessary piece of the healing process. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be angry about harm that you've experienced. It's okay to be angry at the people who hurt you, at the people who didn't protect you, even if they didn't hurt you, right? At the people who were complicit, at whoever. Feel that stuff. Go through all of it, right? And it's okay to say, I don't forgive you. I wish you, on the other side of all of that, right? The rage and the grief and the heartbreak and, you know, all of these other kinds of emotions that people who are hurt are discouraged from feeling, because once again, they're really bad for the status quo. And sometimes on the other side of it, people might want to say, I don't forgive you. What you did is unforgivable, or you haven't done the work. It's not my job to anything you. I might even wish you peace. And by the way, forgiveness and reconciliation are not the same thing. I can forgive you right. And wish you to be far away from me forever. But even I don't forgive you. That's your work to do. Good luck. I'm going to be over here protecting my own peace and boundaries. You know, and that's going to look like a different kind of experience with my therapist. That's going to look like EMDR. That's going to look like somatic healing. That's going to look like different modalities. And it's going to look like a different kind of letting go. But it doesn't have to be in relation to you. It can be making peace with the thing that happened in relationship to me. You know, people want to talk about that one line from the New Testament about forgiving 70 times seven. And a pastor friend of mine pointed out that that actually happens in the context of community accountability. For whatever it's worth.
Yeah.
On the flip side of forgiveness culture, we have cancel culture, mm-hmm. right? Where, you know, we all know what that is. It is obviously a good thing. I think it's a good thing when people get called out for what they've done wrong. I'm certainly not against that. What I feel like the society is sort of missing in that is kind of like a way back or a healing path for that person. Mm-hmm. And it's not that society is the one who owes that person that thing, because obviously the person who has done this wrong thing, obviously it's their responsibility to sort of take those actions, like you were saying. You know, they've got to do the work. But I feel like if society is going to rally around when someone does something wrong, that person deserves to be able to be rehabilitated back into society. And no one seems to be interested in that. How do you feel about that?
So, you know, when I wrote On Repentance and Repair, it really is a roadmap to that kind of work, honestly. There is a process. The bar is not low, right? If you have caused harm, you've got to be willing to do the work. I think what happens a lot is that it's like, oh, person with a lot of talent or connections or money has done something, and we, the institution, want to very quickly go back to using them as a name or a resource or whatever. And so we're going to take this cursory statement and consider that rehabilitation, and that is not helpful. And On Repentance actually came out as a result of Me Too and all these celebrity statements and people on Twitter and these conversations about, like, okay, do we just give Matt Lauer another $6 million contract now that his publicist put something on Instagram, or what? And it's like, if somebody is serious, there are things we who are not the victim, it's not our job to forgive. First of all. But even if someone were serious, there are things we could probably see visibly kind of bobbing up from the surface. And ultimately, like, there is somebody needs to be doing public owning of the harm that they caused. They need to be doing deep work to transform, to become the kind of people that don't do that thing anymore. They need to be doing deep amends, right? They need to be doing deep apology. They need to be making choices that are different choices. Yeah. And so one can see that, you know, for example, Louis C.K. Is my favorite one of these guys to hate. And I don't use that word lightly. But this dude gave a narcissistic public statement, went away for a minute, and then started making jokes about the people he harmed. And his jokes got more racist and more sexist and more transphobic and more everything, right? It's not somebody who's doing the work. It's, you can see from the surface. This is not somebody who's taking seriously the fact that his actions hurt someone else. If the community shows up and surrounds this person, and this is, we're individuals to culture and not a communal culture. If everybody shows up around the person who caused harm and is like, "What are you doing, dude? Come here, sit down. That's not how you treat people." It's the beginning, right?
Yeah. And it's uncomfortable, right? That this person did something that was probably a private thing that became public because people found out about it. And now you've got to do some kind of public version of, I keep calling it rehabilitation just for lack of a better term, because it's, there's all kinds of things that might need to happen depending on what it was. But it's, you know, it's uncomfortably public now because, look, you're a public figure. And I think that there's, you know, we can kind of take that down a notch depending on how famous or not famous the person in question is, right? Because this happens on this is not just a celebrity issue, right? We all do this with our friends and families and all that kind of stuff too.
I think we've got part of the thing that I, you know, if I could ask for the universe to do a thing, I'd love to unhook the idea of messing up with shame.
Mm-hmm.
Human people, we all screw up. We all make mistakes. We're all still learning. And if we can get over the idea that there's something shameful about that, things will start to get easier pretty quickly. I spent a bunch of the good years before it got Nazi on Twitter, and I probably, because of my big mouth and poor impulse control, wound up with a pretty large following. And because of my big mouth and poor impulse control, also made a lot of mistakes and did a lot of my learning in public and had to do that thing in front of a lot of people, you know, a lot of people, of, wow, I just, you know, I just ate it on something that matters a lot to me, right? Something where I, issues where I think of myself as the good guy, as the hero, right? I'm a nice person, I'm, right? And I had to be like, today I ate some white supremacy by accident. I didn't know that. I've always got white supremacy in me because I've been drinking this orange juice and I'm breathing this air my whole life, right? And it's just a question of how much I can try to get out and unlearn constantly. And I accidentally had to unlearn some in public. And so having to say to a lot of people in public, I accidentally found some white supremacy that was still in there. That was really bad. And I'm so sorry. And here's what I'm going to do about it. Okay. I didn't die. Right? Didn't it was not proof that my bones were racist. It was proof that I'm living in a white supremacist culture and had some unlearning to do. Right? And the more we can foster that, there was one time when I absolute furious anger at a colleague about something he said, and it was like really problematic and hurtful. Like he made an academic argument that had like real implications for real people, and I was furious, and it spilled over into nasty personal attack. It was not cool. And I had to eat it publicly, and I had to go after, and I had all these, like I had to apologize again and again and again because he was not responding. And that's, I screwed up. Okay. Right? You clean up,
Yeah.
you make a
I
mess, you
think
clean it up.
the other tricky thing is like who decides when it's cleaned up, right? You feel like you've done your part, you've done the work, but how do you like what if someone else doesn't think that?
That's why we have Jewish law. That's see, that's why we have like, smart dead guys. And it's the process is ever evolving. According to the laws of repentance, thank you, Maimonides, or my 12th century person against whom I sharpen iron, mostly with joy, sometimes yelling. You apologize three times after you have done owning the harm you've caused in public, doing the work to try to real work to change. That means, therapy, rehab, right? Educating yourself on the ignorance, like all of the things, amends, meaningful amends, then apologizing meaningfully three times. Like you apologize once. And if the person isn't hearing it, then you actually it's four times. Then you bring back up some people to check you and make sure you're doing it correctly. And you try to apologize again. And if they're not hearing it, you bring back different people so that you can afterwards be like, did I say something? Was it my body language? And they can be like, dude, do you hear yourself? Right? Oh, that's why they were wasn't landing. 'Cause I, oh, right. You bring back more people. And then finally, if after the third thing with your accountability team, the other person isn't hearing it, then it's on them. And it's between them and God to sort out. So we have a process. There it's somebody has thought about all of this.
My favorite thing that somehow got cut from your bio, but that I didn't get to say is that you not only are this rabbi to watch and a faith leader to watch, but also a Sunday Washington Post crossword clue, 83 down. That's right. I think that's my favorite little bona fide that anyone's had on this show so far. Love it. That's when you know you've made it,
I
rabbi.
know.
The season for us is all about listening, right? That we're trying to do good listening to all these different faith traditions. I shouldn't say to the traditions, to the people who practice them. And so I wanted to ask you about your practice of listening and, ideally listening without agenda. How do you do that? How does one assume a posture of good listening?
I mean, it's hard because I think all of us have all of these layers in front of us. The older I get, I think the easier it is to engage people with curiosity. And when I forget, I'm very blessed to have kids who are now teenagers and almost teenagers, who are delighted to check me and remind me that I don't actually know anything, which helps remind me that I need to shut up and listen. And that I still have so much that I still and always and forever learning from other people is pretty much the best part of all of it.
So the takeaway is get some teenagers in your life. I'm working on it. I got a couple of years.
I beware all who enter here.
Nice. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us and being on the show, Rabbi.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted and an honor.
Yeah. And where's your congregation, or what's your where do you do most of your rabbiing, so to speak?
Right now I am writing full time at lifeisasacredtext.com.
Okay.
And have some other things cooking to be released soon.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
What a great joy being with you today. And thank you so much for just walking us through your own I guess you would say spiritual discovery that seems to continually to be unfolding. And it gives me inspiration too, to keep on seeking and keep on realizing that everything's in process. So
much in process. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
What an interesting conversation with Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg. I get the sense that she is really good with young people. Is that just me? Maybe that just comes with the territory of having teenagers in the house. But I feel like her ministry must have benefited from her style long before she ever had, you know, older kids. And the conversation also left me with a lot to think about regarding forgiveness and reconciliation and healing. I don't know, as a Christian, it wasn't easy to hear, but I also feel like I did learn something. And now we're going to hear from another rabbi. After reading his bio, we're going to head straight into my favorite part of our dialogue together. So at that point in the conversation, we'd already been talking a little bit about different denominations and movements within Judaism. Here is a snippet of our conversation with Rabbi Paul Sidlovsky. Rabbi Paul has 38 years of experience serving congregations across the United States and Canada. As a dedicated partner and teacher, he listens deeply, facilitates meaningful dialogue, and works collaboratively to help communities envision and achieve the next stage of their congregational journey. He provides steady and compassionate leadership through worship, lifelong education, life cycle events, interfaith and community representation, social action, and dynamic social programming. Rabbi Sidlovsky has made Tallahassee his home and has fully embraced the community. His active engagement in interfaith initiatives includes co-chairing the Tallahassee Interfaith Clergy Council and serving on the God Squad with the Village Square, as well as visiting and hosting groups to teach about Judaism. Together with his wife, Wendy, an experienced, valued volunteer and people person, Rabbi Sidlovsky is committed to building a vibrant and inclusive Jewish community in Tallahassee. Their son, Ben, is a graduate of American University in Washington, D.C., and an active member of the Tallahassee community. Rabbi Paul can often be found praying for the Washington Capitals hockey team and welcomes much needed additional help in this area. Rabbi Paul, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. You caught me in the off season since the Caps didn't make the playoffs.
I'm sorry to hear that. I have a friend who lives pretty close over there in the waterfront. So I'm sure he's praying too for next year, I guess, at this point.
Always next year.
I'm curious about the experience of the Jews in these different movements and communities. And I have to use the church as my basis, just because that's what I know intimately. I will say, like, before I started working in a ministry of the church, I was pretty unaware of the fact of the different kind of warring factions that there are within Catholicism. I just wasn't involved enough in the business of the faith, I guess you could say, to really be aware, or even the interworkings of what's going on from all the way from the Vatican to, you know, individual churches. And so I just had no idea how, I don't want to say political, but kind of, right? There's certainly kind of you know, more progressive movements in the church. There's more very more traditional and conservative movements in the church. And I guess my question for you is like, how aware are your Reformed Jew congregants that they are practicing in maybe a different way how much of a choice, like, maybe is it that they're going to this synagogue versus another, you know, the conservative one, or is it just because that's kind of what they grew up with? Or I'm just curious, like, how how active that is in their experience. And then if it plays a role, if it comes into play when they are getting together in these kind of events that you're throwing, where there's more than one congregation coming together.
That's a good question. I think it's some of all the things you've mentioned. So, you know, absolutely, the old joke is two Jews, three opinions. You have different, you know, all different ideas. I had someone who wasn't Jewish years ago say to me, "What I love about the Jewish community is everyone gets along so well." And I had to keep from laughing because even though, you know, we you know, try to respect each other, there's a lot of differences. And like you said, that's a human thing. It happens in the Catholic Church. It happens in Protestant churches. It happens in all sorts of different denominations. You know, people might say, well, it's between Reform and Conservative or Reform and Orthodox. Even within Orthodoxy, there are a lot of different opinions. And even within Reform Judaism, there are a lot of opinions. Within one congregation, there are certainly many opinions. So there is that. And that's something we need to contend with. And again, I believe that, not to be idealistic, but I think it does enrich us ultimately if it's done respectfully. So if we learn to, you know, agree to disagree, to, you know, disagree without being disagreeable, as they say. One of my lines that I use very often, certainly in interfaith work and even within the Jewish community, is no one has a monopoly on the truth, that we all have a different perspective. It doesn't mean anything goes, but I don't believe that there's necessarily one truth. And I distinguish between truth with a capital T and truth with a small t. And by that, I mean, looking at the Bible, for example, I don't see it necessarily as true with a capital T, as in literal. There may be aspects of historical aspects or things like that, but I see it as, and this would be even offensive to some traditional Jews, or they certainly wouldn't agree, I see it as a human document inspired by God, absolutely. And it's humanity's attempt to describe God's interactions with us, God's communications with us, and how we act. So it means, when you look at it for that way, that it is not infallible, and that it was something that was written many years ago. Doesn't mean that it has no value. It has tremendous value, again, inspired by God. So there is divinity to it. But truth with a small t, to me, means it's true in that it's meaningful, not that it's literal. And so I take that when I deal with different people with different opinions. And so, yes, people are going to have their own take. I think it's very similar to what we deal with politically in our country. You know, we have, when we look, I consider there to be a lot of parallels between the Bible and the Constitution, for example, not necessarily in terms of content, but in terms of how people approach it. You know, there are the literalists and the people who say if it's not right there in it, it's not there. But if others will say, no, that was, it's not the spirit of the Constitution, the founding fathers may never have thought of this particular issue because it didn't come up hundreds of years ago. But now, you know, if they were here now, in other words, hypothetically, what would they say about this particular issue? And they would have a broader perspective beyond the exact words that are there. And I think the Bible and the Torah specifically in Judaism, which by that I mean the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, is called the Torah in Judaism, the five books of Moses. And that's what it's all based on. And there's many different interpretations of that, but I think that's why it's such an amazing document. It's universal to me, not that everyone accepts it, but it can be interpreted by all different peoples all throughout the world. And it's also timeless in terms of lasting over centuries, millennia, and hopefully millennia into the future. People can continue to take out of it things that we can't even imagine now, and it'll still have relevance. There's a really interesting story in Jewish tradition of how Moses was sent into the future by God. And he was sitting at the back of a classroom of a famous Jewish rabbi named Akiva, many, many centuries after Moses lived. And he wasn't understanding a thing that was being discussed, not because of the language, but just because he didn't understand the interpretations of the Torah that he's, you know, it was the books of Moses, his books that God gave through him. And finally, one of the students said to Rabbi Akiva, the teacher, "How do you know this?" And Rabbi Akiva responded, I know it because it was passed on from Moses to our ancestors and eventually to us. And then Moses understood that this is the same document, but even he couldn't understand it because it had been interpreted and reinterpreted so many times and still had validity and even more meaning. But if Moses himself couldn't understand it, that's how much for all of us can, to say it's changed tremendously and still has great value. So I like to think of it that way. Again, we don't have a monopoly on the truth. We all have our interpretations, different from 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, different from community to community, and even within our congregation, different opinions. So that to me is how we study Torah. It's kind of a wide-ranging thing. And honestly, that's not a liberal with a small L opinion about things. It is how Judaism traditionally has been. The Talmud, the oral law that was based on the Torah, for hundreds of years, rabbis put together different debates and dialogues and interpretations. They presented all different views, and they didn't even leave out the view that wasn't accepted. They kept it in. Just like in the Supreme Court now, there'll be a dissension, and that will be recorded and mentioned. Even though it's not the accepted law, it is worth mentioning because we live in a democracy. We live in a place where all the views have to be heard. So that is to me the Jewish tradition. I think in the last couple of hundred years, certain elements of the more traditional groups have kind of hijacked that and made it kind of frozen, where you're not allowed to have that creativity in interpreting, as so many of the traditional, very knowledgeable rabbis did for hundreds of years. They haven't allowed for that, other than maybe just getting stricter and stricter, rather than being able to adapt within the framework of the law. So Reform Judaism attempts to grapple with that and maintain tradition while understanding there need to be new interpretations.
That's so interesting on so many levels. I mean, well, first of all, I just think of like the rabbinic commentaries have an embedded type of tradition to it, that become sacrosanct in a way. But that's still off the text. Like even though they go back hundreds of years, it's still an interpretation that's not literally, the text itself. So it's interesting how this happens. I really find everything you're saying so fascinating, and I'm very just fascinated also with how does this land with people, just in general, from your experience, with people who really feel that if you don't have something completely objective that is so constant, that is so sure, if you don't have something like that, what do you have? You just run the risk of always kind of just playing to whatever trend or opinion, whatever is the common way that people want to think, because there's so many people, like we recently celebrate Easter in the Christian tradition, and there's people who like are becoming Christian, becoming Catholic, and they get very excited. It's like, oh, this is something that is part of a long-standing tradition. It is not like part of the common culture of today. It's making a stand. It's countercultural, all those things. Now, granted, I will say I try to kind of back away from that type of zeal, because I don't think, I mean, it's I understand what they're saying, but I also understand too that no matter what anyone says, in the 2,000 years of Catholicism, there's been lots of substantial changes over the years. So it's not as constant as people like it to be. But how have you had to contend with that, with people who be like, this is just too much. We need something that is so permanent so that you don't have to kind of even think about trying to kind of accommodate.
Yeah, that's a good question. So this will not exactly answer your question, my first statement, but mm-hmm. I would just say I kind of deal with it from both sides, so to speak. We have people who are saying what you're saying, and who think, and this is a potential issue that we have to constantly grapple with. I don't claim, again, if I say no one has a monopoly on the truth, I'm not claiming that my brand of religion Reform Judaism or Judaism itself is the best religion. Yes, for me it is what I want to do, what I have grown up with. That's a big part of it, and what I believe. But I understand that for different people, there may be different truths with a small t and different ways of approaching things. So there are those people who say, yes, we have to have a belief. We have to have, if we don't have any core values, what are we? And there are others who just say it's too rigid, it's too much. So I have people come who are interested in considering conversion to Judaism. Very often they come from a tradition. I always ask them their background, not as a test, but just to know where they're coming from. And often the most common answer I get is that people had some religious upbringing. Often it was very dogmatic, and they have a need for that in their life. They have not the dogmatism, but they have a need for religion, spirituality, God in their lives, and they're searching for it, but they weren't satisfied where they were. It was too dogmatic. They didn't like being told, you must do this, you must do that, you cannot think, you cannot question. That was a big one. People always say, I couldn't question, I couldn't ask. You know, intelligent people were saying, I just have a question, I have a thought, what of this? And there was no room for that. And so they say in Judaism, and I say, you have to understand that, yes, Judaism traditionally is very much about questioning. But again, if you have more extremist groups within that religion, it has less opportunity for that in any religion. Every religion has extremists and moderates. So I make sure they're clear that it's not Judaism versus Christianity, so to speak. One is open to ideas and one isn't. It's what the groups within each of those religions, like you said earlier, there are groups within Christianity that have different takes on things. So I do deal with that. As far as the people, we just had in God Squad that was mentioned before that I'm involved with. It's a group of clergy that get together and have discussions with a group of people who come and listen and ask questions. And one of the things we just had was on the 250th anniversary of the country, what do we hold as values? And as usual, we don't reach specific conclusions, but to me, again, it's a balance. There has to be a balance of, it can't be anything goes, and there needs to be some core values that we share. But we cannot be dictating to people, this is what you must believe. I don't believe the country was formulated to have to follow a particular way of thinking. I think what it did was say, as long as you're respectful and follow the general, laws and ways of the country, you can worship and practice your religion how you want. And there's no state or national religion per se. There are those nowadays who are saying, yes, this is a Christian country and we need to do that. Yes, the majority of citizens are Christian, but I don't think it was designed to be a Christian country. However, I think it's very reasonable as a Jew, as a rabbi, as a person, as a citizen here to say, look, I recognize that the majority of people here are Christian and that there are going to be certain things in the society that are Christian. I don't take offense or have a problem. In fact, I'm one of the first in line to argue against those who say we shouldn't call a Christmas tree a Christmas tree. I think that's ridiculous. Calling it a holiday tree is silly. To me, it is just, it's a Christmas tree. Call it what it is. Otherwise, all of us in religions lose our identity. But I shouldn't be forced to celebrate Christmas or to do things. I can enjoy it. I can, enjoy the music and the songs and everything. I can find value in the stories, even when you look at it as an actual religious holiday, even though, again, I don't literally follow those stories. I don't literally follow a lot of the Jewish stories either. I find metaphoric value. I find, truths in it, and I take it from there. I mean, I was just recently thinking about the interesting comparisons between Easter and Passover and how they're both spring holidays of rebirth and renewal, and how they have very similar broad themes of coming out and somehow being freed through either the death and resurrection of Jesus as believed in Christianity, or the coming out of Egypt from slavery to freedom to serve God. all those things not coincidentally happen in the spring at a time of rebirth and renewal. And that to me is what human beings need. Same with Christmas and Hanukkah, which I do not equate at all, but I think they're totally separate holidays, but they both occur in December at the coldest, darkest time of year, because there's a human need even outside of religion. Pagan groups had festivals of light in the coldest, darkest times of the year. The need for that, light candles, sing songs, do whatever, have, you know, hope that the light will overcome the darkness, so to speak. So that's what Hanukkah is about. Seems what Christmas is about. The birth of Jesus transformed to be on December 25th, even though historically it was not, is important to, I see the reasoning for that. So there is a need for that. So I guess what the bottom line I'd say is there needs to be room for both. There needs to be room for the people who need touchstone of tradition, because without it, we are going to lose it. And there's also the need for the people who say, you know what, we can't rely totally on it. We need to continually reinvent and not look at it as sacrosanct and untouchable. So the line that I like to use, and it's been used in other contexts, is that halakha, which is the Hebrew term for Jewish law, the body of Jewish law, has a vote but not a veto. So it is something we should take seriously when we make a decision, not just throw it out the window, but it is not the be-all and end-all of our decisions. And if we do that, then we can respect it, use it, learn from it, but also grow and adapt.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. This has been a pleasure learning from you and hearing your perspective on all this kind of stuff. It's been really good.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, John. I appreciate your time. Your questions were excellent, and appreciate your listening. And I hope some of the words can help, you know, at least evoke some thinking in others, some perspectives, and if there is any way of following up or following through, I'm happy to help with that. But this is what I like to do in general, and so I appreciate your sharing this to an even wider audience, and hopefully helping to spread the word of working together throughout our communities.
Yeah, really excellent.
Thank you for your work. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. Is there anywhere that people can find you online or what you're up to?
Well, the Temple, Temple Israel, Tallahassee, has a website. So if you just looked up Temple Israel, Tallahassee, then you could find the website. It's not the most updated, but it has. And then, people can always email.
All right. Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you both.
So great being with you.
All right, so that was a piece of our great conversation with Rabbi Paul Sidlovsky. It's great to just hear these rabbinic voices in our midst today. It really, I don't know, for a Christian like me, it brings Jesus to the present somehow. After all, Jesus is the first person in textual history to be called rabbi. So it's kind of interesting. This episode sort of marks the end of our time with Judaism. And starting next episode, we're going to be spending a little bit of time with Islam, starting with Dalia Mogahed, who gave one of the top TED Talks in 2016. She is outstanding. You're going to love this. Actually, this whole arc with Islam is really good, if I don't say so myself. Very excited to be sharing this with you. Religion to Reality is, of course, this podcast, but not just a podcast. It is also an interfaith monthly gathering, which you can find out more about if you haven't subscribed to our Substack. It's called Religion to Reality, and you can reach it at religiontoreality.substack.com. You can also find Father John on Substack at johngribowicz.substack.com. Religion to Reality was created and executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.